You're listening to Tech Tank, a bi-weekly podcast from the Brookings Institution exploring the most consequential technology issues of our time. From racial bias in algorithms to the future of work, Tech Tank takes big ideas and makes them accessible. Hello there, I'm Nicole Turner-Lee, co-host of the Tech Tank podcast. I'm excited about today's conversation for a couple of reasons. If you've been keeping up with the latest news, you're likely aware of the significant impact that artificial intelligence, yeah, that good old AI, is having, and in particular, the impact it's going to have on a variety of job markets. From breakthroughs like ChatGPT to what we're seeing in other cutting-edge AI software, it's evident that automation and machine learning are reshaping the landscape of work, not just how we do it, but certain professions are feeling the impact more than others. And among those closely watching these developments are lawyers. Yes, I said it. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a sociologist, but I work alongside a lot of lawyers as I do my research at Brookings. And I'm just intrigued by AI's potential to transform that field. With advancements in AI-driven technologies such as natural language processing, document analysis, the completion of routine tasks like contract review and legal research, they can now be completed with unprecedented speed and accuracy. But, you know, I'm starting to hear that there is somewhat of a divide as those lawyers and actual firms and those who are in front of lawyers in classrooms are researching how to leverage this new technology. And so today's conversation is really about how are we going to deal with generative AI and AI more generally in the future of the law firm? I think I'm going to go right there with it, right? This is not only the law firm in practice, but the students who are going into these esteemed, distinguished law firms. I've got two guests that I am so excited to have here today. One is Mark Brennan, who I go way back with. He's a tech and telecoms partner at Hogan Lovells Law Firm. He leads their global AI working group. And he and I were just on a panel at the American Bar Association. So who better to ask than someone you just spoke to? And John Villasenor, who is a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for Technology Innovation and a professor of engineering and public policy at UCLA. And John is interesting because he deals a lot with this disruption as it relates to education. And I don't know if some of you saw this, he actually wrote our first blog on generative AI in the law firm, and it was one of the most widely read pieces that we've done. So I'm assuming we've got a lot of lawyers listening to this episode as well. So with that, I want to say thank you both for coming on. I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you.
Nicole, thank you.
Yes. Well, let's jump right into it. Mark, I'm going to start with you. We were on that panel together at the ABA. There was a lot of talk about law firms and disruptive technologies. Talk to me a little bit about what you're seeing with AI's disruption in your industry and how you think it's going to impact the legal sector, you know, now and into the future.
Nicole, thank you. And thanks very much for having me today. I also was very excited to have this conversation. And, you know, we had a really interesting discussion at the ABA event. And look, as a profession, we're seeing the development and deployment of this technology on a few fronts. So first, as a firm, we're exploring a number of technologies as are other firms. And you can see over the years, the rapid evolution in things like accuracy, specialization, and others for the different tools. And so just like we would other technologies, we explore the ways in which they can increase value in the services that we provide for our clients. And then alongside our exploration with the tools, many of our clients are looking at a variety of AI technologies. And as you know, many of them also develop these technologies. And so understanding and being close on how the technologies work, the latest iterations, and the ways in which they have the opportunity to solve a number of different challenges and provide solutions to organizations is really interesting. And then finally, the area of AI legislation, regulation itself is continuing to develop rapidly. So in addition to understanding the technologies for our own use, our clients' use, we're also seeing the development of the laws and regulations and increasingly attention by regulators in enforcing those laws and regulations.
So what I like about what you're talking about is like there's the one area where work is being done differently, right? Because of these technologies. And then I also like the fact that lawyers also have to have like a new way in which they sort of interpret and apply, right? Some of these technologies within the legal context. I want to stick with you for a minute, right? Because what are the implications of this technology having like this dual role in the legal profession? You know what I mean? Where some lawyers can use it because it's going to help with some routine task, but at the same time, it comes with a set of maybe regulatory liabilities or opportunities.
Yeah, it continues to be an exciting time because of the opportunities that the tools provide. But it's been important to really press against a sense of dichotomy, right? Like either use a tool or have it be human-based. It's really been a focus on the blend and how you ensure that appropriate human involvement, human oversight are there in different scenarios where it may be needed. And so what we tend to find is, you know, as with any technology, there will be different iterations, different features, and understanding what is a feature, what is a bug, is important, and being really clear on that. And ultimately, you know, the trend line that we're seeing in terms of the tools available for law firms to explore and in the legal profession, there was an initial wave in this area of generally applicable tools where firms were, you know, firms might have had access to some of the same tools that you'd see available to other organizations. But in the last couple of years, there's been a growing trend line of specialization where just like we may have specialized tools for anything from research to invoicing, things on the admin side, we're also seeing specialized tools increasingly available that make use of various AI elements.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting, right? Because at the end of the day, going to you, John, right? This is going to pose some pressure on scholars like yourself when you have to approach these things in the classroom. So like, how do you frame legal education with these technologies at hand?
You know, this is such an interesting question. And in addition to the affiliations at UCLA you mentioned earlier, I also have a faculty appointment and teach at the UCLA School of Law. So I'm very much, you know, in the middle of this dialogue. I'll say a few things. First of all, I think as tempting as it may be to educate today's law students for the world that we came of age in, I think we have to resist that temptation and educate them for the world they're going to practice law in, which is really the mid-21st century, a period spanning from, you know, basically now through, for many of them today, into the 2060s and 2070s. So that's a period of time where AI is going to be widely available and very capable. I also think it's important to distinguish between sort of the different kinds of legal writing. You know, academic writing in the legal field, as in any other academic field, it has to be original. You have to break new ground. You have to make a point. You can't just copy other people's work, obviously. But beyond that, you want to make an original point. By contrast, and certainly there's a lot of attorneys or people with JD degrees who do engage in academic scholarship. But I think a lot of writing in the legal field is not academic scholarship. So for example, if your job is to write a contract to hire a contractor for a company, it's not your goal to write a contract that is differentiable from every other contract for that kind of thing ever written in the past. In fact, it's almost the opposite, which is that, you know, somebody somewhere has probably kind of encountered, you know, whatever issue you're trying to address in the contract. And so, you know, borrowing liberally from, you know, prior contracts is not only responsible, it would be sort of irresponsible to try to create something like that really completely from scratch. And there's a lot of examples of how attorneys will write where you really want to use a lot of things from the past. That doesn't mean you don't want to add your own sort of, you know, a twist on it that's specific to the particular arrangement at hand, but you would never want it to be literally completely different from every other, say, employment contract ever done in the past. That would be irresponsible. So I think we need to be sensitive in legal education to kind of making students aware of the different contexts of how they're going to be writing and the different potential uses for AI in those different contexts.
Well, and that brings up like a question, and Mark, I don't know if you want to chime in, right? as a person who is actually in the firm, is that going to create for you some steadiness if you know that students are being exposed to that within the classroom prior to getting to your law firm, right? Or is there some like on the job practice, and are law firms maybe going to have different policies, right, for how the lawyers in the firm actually use the technology?
It's such an interesting arc, because to give a comparison set here, there was a period of time where schools were really focusing on the question of how much to educate students on online research and the ability to use some of the research tools available electronically for court precedent, statutes, and so forth. And then it shifted to, well, how much should we continue? You know, we definitely need the electronic training. How much should we continue to focus on making sure that people know how to actually go to the library and grab the books? And I think we're at, frankly, a pretty early stage in that arc when it comes to the new tools that are available that make use of AI. And by that, my suggestion would be that, you know, any of the students and associates out there, people that are learning, you really do still need to make sure you are very clear on the research, the precedent, being able to grab the primary sources. There may be instances as you're developing in which you're developing inspiration and some of the writing styles and so forth. But I think a lot of the tools are still really preliminary on that. And there's no substitute for knowing the material and being able to see and compare and develop creative arguments based on what you found.
Yeah, I mean, in that part, John, I want to come back to you on that. So I think about like architecture. Yes, I'm saying it, architecture. We're talking about law, but I want to talk about architecture. My dad was an architect before he passed. And I just remember how like he was so resistant to CAD, right? Because he was like, I want to hand draw everything because there's a special unique talent that I bring to the pen and paper. And now I'm being asked to use CAD because most clients want to use the electronic tools that are available because it's for efficiency purposes. You know, I was thinking what Mark said, John, right? My sister, she was a lawyer. Now, Frances Turner, if you ever watch TV, she's an actress. So she started in law. Now she's on TV. Sort of like you guys, right? One is in Washington. One is in LA. That's my sister, right? So she's now more into the entertainment side of it. But I'm thinking about, you know, one of her things that she always spoke about when she was going through law school was using LexisNexis and all these other things to identify the right case law and to get the arguments. But at the end of the day, you know, in her case, she didn't really litigate in front of a judge often because she was doing mergers and acquisitions. But in what way does the law legal profession like battle that, like what Mark was talking about, like this creativity and ingenuity, like that hand to paper model versus using technology and sort of making a quick, efficient fix, but not necessarily bringing your whole self, you know, to the profession?
Well, I think Mark is absolutely right that the legal profession, to practice it well, has always required, you know, an exhaustive knowledge or, you know, huge amount of, you know, an attorney who's a good attorney is going to really pour themselves into learning the specifics of a particular matter and understanding the relevant case law and really thinking creatively about the arguments. And I don't think that's going to change at all. What will change, though, of course, is the tools that the person has that they can bring to bear on making that process more efficient, both in terms of the discovery, for example, of relevant case law, and as well as expressing that, you know, for example, if someone is trying to write a motion to submit to a court, I don't think we're near the point where you can just push a button and have the motion sort of pop out. But I think we are actually not that far away from the point where you might be able to push a button and have it produce some aspect of a credible outline first draft, which will be sort of, you know, useful in some ways and not useful in other ways, but that might nonetheless shorten the end-to-end process of creating it. And so, you know, but you're still going to need the absolutely, you know, refined human judgment to use those tools and know when to use them and know when to disregard them in order to be effective at practicing law. And of course, the other thing I'll mention is that this is a moving target. And I think Mark hinted at this as well. We're early days. We're having the conversation in 2024. You know, just as the internet of today is fundamentally profoundly different from the internet in the late 1990s, I would expect that the tools for the legal profession and AI available in 20, 25 years are going to be fundamentally different than they are today. So the best we can do is have the conversation based on the technology we see today, understanding that it's likely going to change incredibly.
Yeah, no, I mean, Mark, you know, just to stay on that, your law firm, are you thinking that way? Like, okay, this is going to change, you know, because I'm really curious too in terms of investments, because that's another procurement, right, that you have to make, particularly if they're coming out of John's class and they're ready to jump into these tools. It appears to me that the law firm has to make them available too, right?
I think it's really important. And you know, the recommendation to people who are maybe at the earlier parts of their career arc is to make sure you're engaging with these new technologies. One of the most impactful steps that I had taken before I entered the profession was I had immersed myself at the time in HTML and coding and learning how to build websites and understanding how the advertising market had worked on the back end. And anytime you're working in a space in the legal profession, it really helps to have a clear understanding of your client's business, how their services work, how they operate. So if this is an area, if we're talking broadly about, you know, technology and so forth, that you find yourself gravitating to, then immerse yourself in the underlying technology, because then the legal pieces behind it are, you know, you may find those attractive. And then from the perspective of how we're working with the technologies to solve our clients' challenges, this is an area where, you know, we're presented with new opportunities every day as the technologies evolve. And anytime there can be these examples, and John mentioned some, where a tool can provide significant efficiency for our clients, that's great. I don't think we're trying to push the boundaries, for example, of, you know, is something accurate enough or not? We don't want to go anywhere close to that line. But if you have a tool where it can provide a draft of a filing that's been done 100 times, right? Or a particular type of document that gets used in a particular area for certain agreements, and it can populate certain aspects of that, that can be helpful. And it allows our people and the clients to really focus their time and attention on some of the issues that might be most contentious, most unresolved, most novel, and ultimately being able to center ourselves around some of the most complex and interesting questions is where a lot of our people want to be.
Well, that brings me to another question, right? Because I'm thinking about like the work that I do when it comes to like bias. And, you know, to one extent, we want people to use these tools, particularly in like, you know, again, professions which are very highly textual, and where research could benefit by the availability of, you know, technologies that just make our jobs a lot more efficient and easy. I mean, I'm a researcher, I get it. But then, you know, sometimes these tools, particularly things like generative AI, curated models, or, you know, John just published a really great piece on just some of the technology cadence that, you know, may obscure some diversity filters. My point is, how do you also deal with the ethical considerations associated with the development of AI? Not all lawyers are sitting at the table with the technologists actually creating these tools, but we're buying them because we're sort of being sold a bill of goods that this can help us with our work, you know, and how we organize our work and do our work. How do you address that? Like, John, how do you address bias and ethical considerations when it comes to sort of moving people into a space where we still have a few more kinks to work out?
Yeah, there's definitely some kinks. I guess I would just say a couple of things. First of all, I would say that ethical considerations are a kind of a broader category, and bias is one of the many. You know, if there's any silver lining with the bias problem, and I'm not in any way understating it because it is a big problem, if there's any silver lining, it's that there's a really high level of awareness of the problem, right? There's really very few people working substantially in or with AI who aren't at least aware that it's a concern. And the glass half full way to look at it is that, well, this high level awareness, you know, means that the companies that provide these tools are very attuned to it. And it doesn't mean they're going to do a perfect job, but I think they're going to try, and things are going to certainly get better. And I also think that the users of AI are by and large aware of it as well. And they're not going to get it perfect either, but I think, you know, they're going to do much better than they would have if they, you know, they didn't have that top of mind. And then there's the other ethical considerations that might arise that are, say, separate from bias. And I think it's incumbent on any attorney, and really any practitioner of any profession who's using any sort of technology, to keep in mind the potential ethical concerns that might arise with these technologies. Let me also just close by flipping it around a little bit and saying that there's some ways in which AI can actually help mitigate some ethical concerns. For example, I think AI has the potential to broaden access to legal services. One of the big problems with current legal services is that they really exclude a vast number of people because of the pricing and things like that. And so I think to the extent that AI can help create an opportunity for a greater number of people to have access to those services, that's a win. So I think the, you know, again, not to downplay the ethical potential problems, but also there's some ways that AI can actually be of benefit as well.
So what you're saying is, and like Mark, I want you to jump in, right? So you're saying we've got to be aware. So when these tools are before, you know, law students and lawyers in particular, but, you know, managing the ethics may be something that can be done. I'm thinking because a lawyer is probably using it. Maybe they're thinking about all the good and the worst case use scenarios, right? And so they're sort of thinking about that as they use it. Is that what you're suggesting, that there's just like a peaked awareness among this profession in particular, or something, you know?
I think any profession, and I guess, you know, ethics needs to be at the foundation of any profession, really. And you know, an engineer we give our engineers ethics training, right? And some of that has to do with, you know, AI technologies, but some of that has nothing to do with AI technologies. And I think AI just adds sort of one more aspect of the ethical landscape that a professional, including a legal professional, needs to keep in mind as they carry out their work.
Yeah, I mean, because Mark, I'm thinking about something that you had said in our panel discussion at ABA, which is like, the legal liability from autonomous models. So at the end of the day, let's say you have someone who's using AI, maybe they know a little bit about it, maybe they don't, but the AI itself actually creates another layer of legal liability. And I think you had talked about this, which I thought was so interesting. I mean, how are law firms handling this with their clients, and how are they handling it internally, you know, to make sure that, you know, someone who's really rambunctious about using the technology is also realizing, like, you can't sue the algorithm, you know, like, somebody is liable for this, you know?
Nicole, that's a really interesting question. So I was thinking about what John said, and this these questions around who should be in the room, and lawyers and ethicists and the different backgrounds. And so, look, clients come to us, and we are trained and practiced at answering the question, you know, is this compliant? Does this comply with the law? Is this illegal? What are the risks? What are the outcomes here? But we do not routinely get asked, should we do this or not? And that's really, in my view, an important role to have somebody at the organization who's an ethicist or has that background, you know, somebody that isn't coming at from this particular perspective. And I think underscores more broadly that when we're discussing AI bias and other concerns that have been raised, that you have a cross-functional team, different backgrounds, different experiences, and just really have this ultimately a diverse team exploring the risks, the benefits, and making those decisions collectively about whether something should or should not be done.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? I would think, John, that's the same thing that should apply, you know, for folks who are pursuing law as their final stop, but, you know, also getting them more involved, right? Engage in ways in which they can serve cross-functionally in the firm. I like that idea because, like, I'm thinking, like, as we are seeing with engineering students and computer science students, as John was talking about, I was at Harvard many years ago, and they're trying to start to teach ethics. And John, you've been teaching ethics. And, you know, it's one of those things where perhaps this is something that is just standard across the board when it comes to legal education. My other thing, though, is, I think this conversation we're having is really like been an easy one. It's very easygoing. We're kind of talking about this tech, but there are a lot of contentious conversations when it comes to ChatGPT, right? And in particular, the extent to which it is being used for legal work, and it could potentially displace some people out of the profession because of its, you know, granularity in being able to do their job. John, I mean, are these like fears? Is it more so a reshifting and transformation of the profession itself? Maybe it's way overdue. how do we preserve like the paralegal jobs and other jobs in the law firm that could be replaced by such technology? So we'd be looking at, is this disruption or opportunity to make it much more modernized?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be, I think you can certainly talk about the impact of AI on the labor market more broadly, but I don't think in the legal profession, it's going to be really wholesale replacing legal professionals. I think it's going to be a tool that will allow legal professionals, both attorneys and paralegals, for example, to operate much more efficiently. But I don't see, you know, there's really interesting survey, I think McKinsey did a couple of years ago, it was about a bunch of professions, but one of the key takeaways was that there's really very few professions where sort of all of it, the whole thing, everything anyone does in a particular profession can be automated away. And I think that's true with AI as well. So some fraction of the tasks that anybody, including me, do will be made, you know, a lot more efficient with AI. But some won't. The last weekend I spent a whole bunch of time grading student essays. I just can't imagine that that's something that AI would be able to do. I had to do that by hand. And so I think AI is going to make it a lot more efficient for some of these things. Let me just give one example. Attorneys, when they're preparing for trial, one of the things they're going to do is they will often spend an enormous amount of effort preparing trial exhibits, you know, basically PowerPoint slides to use and show in a courtroom. And I can see AI being something that can make that process a lot more efficient. But that doesn't mean that we're not going to still need firms that specialize in creating these sort of graphics. It's just that they're going to be using these tools and they're going to have better graphics. And I'll just close by saying, you know, you could have asked the question in the 1990s is the internet going to, you know, replace, you know, lawyers or something like that? And it just made, you know, attorneys, everybody up their game, right? And so I think that's going to happen in many ways with AI as well.
Well, Mark, I'll go over to you, right? I was at a university speaking before a bunch of lawyers, and a young lady said, well, is this going to change our billable hours in the traditional billing model, you know, with regards to generative AI and other AI technologies? In your law firm and others that you are, you know, aware of, are we seeing some of this help with productivity as well as like decreasing some expenses? Or do you think like, Mark, you know, it's not going to do a wholesale replacement. If anything, it just may help the industry just get better.
So maybe a little bit of context here. So I happen to be someone that has made a career out of spending my time on unsettled, novel, complex issues that come up in the technology space. I routinely don't get to, you know, reuse materials because overnight the technology changes, right? So some people may be in a practice where they work on the same, you know, it'll be a particular industry or the same regulation over time. And for these areas, the frameworks change overnight. And we're living through a time, and John mentioned the development of consumer internet use, and that we've seen this widespread deployment and adoption of major technologies. I was thinking when you were describing, like, I'm sure the manufacturers of telephone wires went through a major industry change, right, you know, over the past 20 years, but we still need other things now for our mobile devices. But I also want to be mindful. I want there to be the space for the major macroeconomic, geopolitical, trade, employment issues that really do tie into the core policy discussions that we're having now around technology and AI. And my sense is I really don't know which direction some of these speculative paths may take. It could be that there will be a significant impact to jobs, resourcing, overall economic modeling in the legal profession and other professions. We don't have clarity around that. And I think anybody that would say we're definitely going to have, you know, decimation or definitely going to be completely unbothered by it, I think that's a much more complicated story, and we're at the very early stages of that. And in my view, one of the best steps that people can be taking in this profession is to familiarize themselves with the technology, figure out where it can be helpful and additive, figure out where the focus should be on you know, how we spend our time, and making sure that as we engage with these technologies, that we're there as a meter to address potential bias, fairness, and other concerns, and aren't contributors to the problem.
Right. Well, this is so interesting, right? You know, I feel like you both are in my living room and we're just sitting at the table having this conversation on a Saturday night, right? Because I'm starting to think in my mind a couple of things. Like, first, these tools are going to revolutionize this industry because it is going to help people become more efficient in ways where they're very rote tasks and people have to sort of do the same things over again. So it's okay to have AI sort of help you with that. But then I'm thinking, like, in the back of my mind, there are going to be a lot of lawyers going after some of these companies too for a variety of regulatory and legislative concerns. And how will the profession sort of reconcile this identity that they may have, right? Where they want to use it because it's helpful, but the same token, it's a fine line. I'm not going to name out any companies because this is not the focus of this podcast, but like there are some companies that are being, you know, sort of harassed by a lot of lawyers right now or having a whole lot of lawyers preserve their integrity. How does the law profession actually manage that balance? I'm so curious. Like, how are you going to do it?
Nicole, I have no doubt that the plaintiff's bar will be major early adopters of AI technologies that can hammer out template complaints. No doubt. But I also expect that as part of the changes we might see, that there will be, you know, there's a lot we're going to find out about how courts will interpret the existing laws, not to mention the new laws that seem to be passing regularly now. So for example, you know, AI really presents, my sense, a once in a generation scenario where you have multiple areas of key unsettled issues in the law all intersecting. So AI brings up a number of unsettled issues in IP and copyright law. It brings up a number of unsettled issues in the US on intermediary liability in Section 230 and outside the US on those intermediary liabilities as well. And it also brings up unsettled issues around product liability, who is the speaker, who is the author, who's the developer, who's the distributor, things like that. And we're just seeing all of those areas collide in ways that prior major technologies didn't really hit all of those. And we've got a big First Amendment issue lurking in the background too.
What do you think, John? Because I know that these are issues that you deal with at Brookings in particular on the constitutional law and interpretation of the law. How do you see this playing out in a space where we may see some legal affronts, right, to some of these technologies as they roll out? And how do we reconcile this?
There's a whole slew of ongoing lawsuits right now against providers of generative AI systems. And the courts are going to be ruling on these things in the next year or two. I mean, the question really is the use of other people's copyrighted work without permission to train these systems, does that or does that not fall within the protections of the fair use exception to copyright infringement that we have in copyright law in the United States? And so we're going to have to see, but I would expect we're going to get a lot of clarity, a lot more clarity, at least than we have today, in the next year or so from the courts. And that will, of course, inevitably impact how these generative AI systems are trained, because they're going to have to comply with whatever these courts decide. So that's a major policy issue that goes way beyond the application and law. That applies to generative AI across the board.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I guess, you know, as a kind of wrap you up, because I could keep you guys forever. But that's why I think about, you know, this conversation and the evolution of these technologies. One, they are going to have these very productive elements to them that are going to just revolutionize a variety of industries. And I think the legal profession is one of them in which we're seeing a lot of that movement, which is, again, why I was so excited to have this conversation with the American Bar Association, because we're normally talking about other stuff. And so this is a really interesting conversation to have on the side of the profession itself, right? And how work is organized. But then I can't help but think about what you just said, John, right? That some of the tools themselves may have implications that lawyers have a particular interest in, either litigating or supporting, and how this industry reconciles that in the future. I mean, for those of us that are sitting on the sidelines, will be interesting, right? Because, you know, it may actually go up against some of the liability protections that you all have. I mean, going forward, I'm just curious from the two of you, is this going to be a space that's going to stick around for a while, or is it going to be a space of disruption that may go through its ebbs and, you know, flow a little bit differently than other technologies that we've seen before? And, you know, Mark, I'm thinking about LexisNexis was a technology when it was introduced, right? So I'm just curious, like, are we going to see this stand its ground in the legal profession, or are we going to see some movement in different directions? What would you sort of prognosticate going forward?
I'm excited to find out. And and my sense is the landscape will change. So I think when you look at the, when you look at the marketplace now, you look at the landscape, who's offering which technologies, there are many large resourced organizations that are focusing on where these technologies are at, where they can go. And when you see that much interest coalescing around an area, to me, that suggests a lot of interesting times ahead. So I think, for example, you'll see continued disruption. You'll see new iterations. So I wouldn't expect, you know, Me Too varieties of the technologies, but you'll see those that may start to specialize with certain verticals, certain industries. You may see technologies that look to solve other issues. And one area that I'm particularly excited to see is where the life sciences and healthcare space may progress in the next few years. I am really interested to see what new patient outcomes we can develop by having the data sets available and connecting dots that previously had not been available to physicians. So that's an area in particular I'm focused on.
Yeah, I'll just say that, you know, as the saying goes, predictions are hard, especially about the future. I think there's no question that AI is here to stay. And that's true in terms of its use in the legal profession, as well as its use in, you know, an endless list of other areas. Now, what exact form that's going to take, I think it's really hard to say with any specificity where that's going to go. And I'll just illustrate that with a quick analogy. Back in the late 1990s, I'm old enough to remember when people first got widespread access to the internet. You know, I could have told you back then that the internet was going to make it, you know, a lot easier to find information and to convey information to people. And I and anybody else who thought about it would have thought of that and been right about it. But I completely missed social media. I didn't see in the late 1990s, I did not foresee social media and the way that was going to really just change the entire contour of the kind of online ecosystem. And so I think we are as ill-equipped today to foresee what may end up being some of the most transformative and impactful aspects of AI 10, 15, 20 years from now, as we were in the late 90s to seeing the most transformative effects of the internet. But it's I am confident in saying that the impact is going to be very substantial. And I'm hopeful that there are going to be amazing benefits, as Mark alluded to, in pharmaceuticals and drug development. I'll add another one, which is, you know, AI has incredible potential for things like climate modeling and weather forecasting. There's just a long list of areas where it stands to really bring some extraordinary benefits. And like any technology, it can be misused. And so we're going to have to be on guard for that as well.
Well, you know, the two things that you just said, John, that I want to follow up on, I think we should do a series on that, right? Because I think really people are just longing for information on how AI is going to basically disrupt or be integrated into their profession. And the second thing is, John, I didn't know that you were a 90s kid. I'm a 90s kid. And my book, The Digital Divide, it's entitled, folks, Digitally Invisible, How the Internet is Creating the New Underclass. It starts in the 90s. So we're going to have to share some stories about the 90s.
Yeah, and full disclosure, I don't think I qualified as a kid in the 90s.
I don't think I did either, but I was just trying to save face because I don't want people to guess when we were born.
I was already out of school and working, so... I was an earlier than 90s kid.
Yeah. Okay. So for that, for clarification, for those of you wondering, I was just getting out to school just by a little bit. So he may be a little bit sooner than me. Mark, we're going to leave you out of this story here. Listen, I think what you all have spoken about is really important, and I'm glad we had this conversation. It just has been so interesting to see how this conversation in and of itself has progressed. I want to thank you both for coming on to the Tech Tank podcast.
Well, thank you.
Nicole, thank you so much for having us. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is fun. And it's also informative, right? Folks, you're listening to the Tech Tank podcast, where you know we make complex bits into palatable bites, especially when we're addressing and unpacking technology issues. I want you to be sure to look for this podcast and like it. If it was something that resonated for you, share it with others. And be sure to pay attention to the Tech Tank newsletter, where you will find much more information from the people that were on this particular episode and others, where we're trying to always make technology policies much more explainable. I'm Nicole Turner Lee, and we will see you next time. Thank you for listening to Tech Tank, a series of roundtable discussions and interviews with technology experts and policymakers. For more conversations like this, subscribe to the podcast and sign up to receive the Tech Tank newsletter for more research and analysis from the Center for Technology Innovation at Brookings.